Do you think when a celebrity gets married and the pictures end up on People magazine in an exclusive, like, do they pay for that? Do you think, like, People pays for it? The reason I ask is that the Star Tribune right now has a story up about a woman I know. I think she's fantastic. The former bachelorette, Michelle Young. And Michelle Young co-emceed the Children's Hospital Winefest Gala with me. What a thrill for her, I'm sure. Sharing a stage with me.
Probably a bigger highlight than the wedding.
I don't know why, though. Why didn't those pictures get sent to People magazine? I don't know. So she gets married. Fine. Like, great. Good. We're happy, right? Like, I love love. You're pro-love. We're all pro-love. But, like, bachelorette alum, is that, like, worthy of a People magazine exclusive? Like, did she didn't win. She didn't marry a guy from The Bachelor. She married a guy from Minnesota. She was the runner-up on, she was The Bachelorette. Well, all right. So maybe is that why it's a thing? Because she was The Bachelorette. Could you guys tell me if this is a thing? Like, I get a little confused by it because I know this woman. And I just think, like, she's a nice lady. She's very talented. She's quite beautiful. I don't know. She married this another nice dude. He was like a gopher. But it's sort of hilarious. Like, Chad gives me a hard time about all of my sponsorship. But this story in People magazine is like, it name checks like every single, dressed in a tuxedo from Suit Shop, Jack Lais had made his way down the aisle to Lovers and Friends by Lil Jon and the East Side Boys. Like, I don't know. The couple then exchanged rings from Wedding Day Diamonds. It's just so weird. I don't know. Good for them. What the heck, right? But then some poor intern for the Star Tribune, this guy Lincoln Roch, you're like, I don't know. When I was a kid, and I was interning at ABC News, you're like, oh, man, like I've made it. I'm interning at the big media organization in Lincoln, interning at the Star Tribune. Like, I don't know if this is Lincoln's first story that he wrote for the Star Tribune. Oh, no, this is his third. You're like, hey, Lincoln, go write this story about two people who got their wedding sponsored. And it's in People magazine. I don't know. This is so strange. Let's do the D-Rush Hour news headlines featuring far
now,
more
time
important
to get you caught up on some of the biggest stories of the day. These are the D-Rush Hour headlines.
Good evening. Our top story.
This just in.
Our top story.
We begin tonight.
We begin tonight.
We begin tonight.
We begin tonight.
We begin with the lead.
And I want to start with that news story that you just heard a little bit of from Mark Fry, talking about the University of Minnesota Regents who had their houses vandalized. Now, I understand that I am not always going to be in touch with the issues that get activists fired up. But this story about the university selling a piece of land and protesters being mad about it because the land is being sold to a company that is probably going to use it for some sort of military purpose feels like it's out of, like, the 1960s. This land is the ruins of an ammunition plant. And so we're mad that, like, it's just supposed to sit there. 60 acres. Being sold for $8 million in a deal that the Regents approved more than a month ago, but apparently people just paid attention to it, and protesters, in fact, went so far, at least that's the allegation, that it was a protester, and who the heck else would do this, but protesters went so far as to vandalize the homes of four University of Minnesota Regents. Just outrageous. One of the Regents told his story to Vanita Sakkar this morning.
It is. It's very troubling. You know, I have a friend who serves on the University of Michigan Board of Regents who's had damage and vandalism to not only his home, but his office as well. And so it can extend to that. And that's what we're seeing across the country. I believe in dialogue and discourse being very important and cornerstone, you know, to good public policy making. There should be dialogue and discourse around what's going on with our state's land grant R1 University. And as a governing board member, I believe in engaging in that. You know, my cell phone number, my personal cell phone number and my university email address have been on our board webpage since I was elected in March of 2021. So I really welcome engagement and welcome the chance to talk to folks that have concerns, questions, feedback, suggestions around issues that come in front of our board. But I think we should lean into dialogue and constructive dialogue, even when it's uncomfortable and even when we may disagree. But this kind of way of expressing feelings on matters is just really disappointing and discourages folks from serving in these roles that I think are really important. You know, right now we're in the middle of a region election. And when people see stuff like this, maybe they're going to be rethinking about wanting to take on that service, which I think we need more people willing to engage in this type of service. So it just does has so many negative impacts across the board, and it's just really discouraging.
That's James Farnsworth, the U of M regent, one of the victims of the vandalism on with Vanita this morning. Just outrageous. Whatever your cause is, we need to be very, very definitive about saying we are not going to allow protesters to come to the home of elected officials. We're not going to allow this sort of vandalism. It's, you know, you may disagree with something that a university is doing, but to target the regents is just outrageous. Next up on the lead, something that Blois Olson wrote about in the Daily Agenda in his morning take. And you could subscribe at thedailyagenda.com. But Blois wrote about a little Minnesota on Minnesota violence. What was going on yesterday on Capitol Hill with Republicans from Minnesota lining up to attack the Democratic governor? Blois writes this. Representatives Tom Emmer, Michelle Fischbach, and Pete Stauber missed their opportunity to truly press Walz on his rhetoric and record. While Walz had a dull performance, it was more civil than the anger of the three Minnesota GOPers that questioned him. The real issue is that Minnesotans don't trust anyone. And why would they? That this is part of politics today. There used to be a bit of a tradition where we felt like Minnesotans were different than politicians all around the country, that Minnesotans, you know, we had respect for each other, even political party that we disagree with. You still respected the service, respected the office. Yesterday, what we saw was a reality that I do think Minnesotans have to get their arms around. We're not better than anybody. Our politicians are as politician-ish as anywhere else. Governor Walz is as guilty as anybody else in this. But we're not special. And I'm sad about that. I'm sad about that. I do think that should disaster come, our politicians, regardless of their party, will work together. But I don't know, man. Like, that used to be a given where we wouldn't have to worry about it. Today, I'm not so sure. Everybody's looking for that gotcha moment. And I think yesterday, for Minnesota politics, I think yesterday was one of the low points. I do. It was embarrassing and not the way that I want political leaders to act. All right, one more story in the lead before we get to page two. And this is a Supreme Court decision in an Osseo Schools case that has ramifications all around the country. Dr. Peter Larson is with us to break down what this means. Because the Supreme Court took on a case, a local case from a family that was trying to sue the school district. But sort of the complicated behind the scenes of this could end up being a very major deal for a lot of school districts all around the country, Peter.
You're right that it's rare to see this level of unanimity with this current court. I would say it's a simple, straightforward decision, but it's a meaningful and a very impactful decision.
Obviously, school districts around our area and around the country now should brace for a number of lawsuits, I would think. This opens the door for really an incredible amount of litigation against schools for not accommodating various disabilities, right?
Yes, in some ways, yes, that's true. What this decision did today was clarified the legal standard by which students could bring litigation. A number of circuits or geographical regions had adopted a higher standard. And what the court did with this decision was they said, no, actually, there is no higher requirement for these educational cases. It's the same standard that we use with other challenges under the Americans with Disabilities Act or Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act.
This specific case involved a young child who had seizures that tended to happen in the morning. So the family wanted an accommodation of a school day that would be like noon to 6 p.m., which as someone who doesn't have a child with a disability, you do look at this and think like, holy moly, the fact that you can kind of create your own academic environment is pretty remarkable. And also, it appears to be the law that you can get those kind of accommodations. When you look at the big picture of this, what's your takeaway as to what this will mean going forward?
That's a great question. Congress passed the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, which guaranteed that all students are entitled to a free and appropriate public education. And within that, we've seen that a number of accommodations are allowed. The idea with this was that we would be integrating individuals with disabilities into the schools, into these mainline classrooms. And Congress promised initially that they were going to cover up to 40% of this cost of per student accommodation. In reality, that number has never gotten above 15 or 16% and oftentimes has been lower. So when you look at the reasonability of these accommodations, yes, you know, it can seem unreasonable, and it may seem even more unreasonable to those school districts who have to shoulder that cost. However, if you're looking at this from the viewpoint of the individuals with those disabilities, certainly it's going to be a large benefit for them, and it's a benefit for the children within those schools who are able to have a wide exposure of different individuals in the classrooms.
Yeah. From a legal standpoint, whether this is difficult to pay for or whether it's difficult for the schools isn't really the issue. Congress passed a law. The Supreme Court upheld what that law was. That's pretty much the bottom line, right?
I think that's exactly right. That's the bottom line.
Very interesting. Peter Larson, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
That is the D-Rush Hour News Headlines lead. Page 2 is coming your way in just a minute. So much to talk about in page 2, including the Rapidan Dam. Remember that bursting? One store, one home had to shut down. It's relocated. What do Americans think about the protests in California? And interesting conversation with Cheryl Reeve about how you coach Hall of Famers. That's coming up. D Rush Hour News Headlines continuing with page 2. And we begin with a question that I was wondering about after the Rapidan Dam burst. Remember when that dam burst and we were like, well, there's not that much around there. But there was one house and one restaurant and store that got wiped out.
It's our legacy. We want to keep it going, and we're proud of our parents.
For Jenny Barnes and her brother David Hershka, the past year has brought about many changes. In May, the Dam Store restaurant their family has run for more than 50 years officially reopened in downtown Mankato.
That's Channel 4's John Lauritsen. Jenny Barnes and her brother David Hershka relocated. So that restaurant that they ran for more than 50 years is now in downtown Mankato, which is, you know, I mean, it's not exactly right near there. But 6 days a week they're open, getting it done, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Pretty cool stuff. It's nice to see them giving it a go again. But if you're down in Mankato, go give them a little support. They've been through it. Best Damn Store is what they call it, but the Damn Store Cafe now on South Front Street in Mankato. Bring cash. Something charming about a cash-only cafe as well, except if you don't have cash. What do Americans think about the protests in Los Angeles?
Justice!
Washington Post and George Mason University texted more than 1,000 Americans, including more than 200 Californians, to ask. And what I found interesting is that, man, we're so divided. You look at the same stuff and you're like, 41% support Donald Trump sending the National Guards and the Marines to respond. 44% don't. 39% support the protests in L.A. 40% oppose. 35% think the protesters have been mostly peaceful. 37% mostly violent. The real divide is with people who are paying attention and who are not paying attention. Because there's a big difference depending on how much you're watching. The truth is Democrats are watching more. Well, they're watching the protest coverage more, and Republicans are watching the military coverage. We really are two different countries, aren't we? Banking appears to be the future of the IDS in downtown Minneapolis. Yeah. Money. Allison Kaplan, the editor of TCB Magazine, writing about the expansion of Associated Bank's headquarters and move to IDS. So if you look at IDS, there was a time where it was two stories of retail. And now there are six financial institutions in that building. It is, the Crystal Court is so cool. I do love that space in downtown Minneapolis. But Nordstrom Rack, gone. Gap Store, gone. Banana Republic, Love from Minnesota, Rocco Altobelli Salon, Hubert White, all of it gone. The leasing agent says they're optimistic because finally people are talking about retail deals down there. But it's all banks. Associated Bank, U.S. Bank, Bank of America, Huntington Bank, Wells Fargo, Fargo and Bremer, which will soon be Old National. Finally, how do you coach people who are Hall of Famers?
Here is Moore. Good ball fake. Cuts between two. Make it a third. And scoops it in with the left hand. Wizardry from Maya Moore.
So this is the same question that people ask my boss, Brad Lane. They're like, Brad, how do you, you know, when you're just surrounded by excellence, when you're surrounded by people like Dan Cook, future radio Hall of Famers, DeRusha, who will probably create his own Hall of Fame if he doesn't get into the Minnesota. So Cheryl Reeve is who The Athletic talked to. And it was a really interesting story because, you know, look at Cheryl Reeve. Simone Augustus, Sylvia Fowles, Maya Moore, Lindsey Whalen. Nafisa Collier will likely be a Hall of Famer, and that include the Olympic team that she coached, all those Hall of Famers. She said the key is holding them accountable to standards even beyond their wildest imagination for their own abilities. Great players want to be coached, and great players never think they're good enough. But she did note that over the years, players want to be talked to in a different way than it used to be. She could be a little tougher. Now she is trying to figure out how to use her words in a way that is more effective. That's the D-Rush Hour News headlines on this Friday afternoon. The Minnesota Twins could use a little bit of coaching help. Maybe Dan Hayes has the answers as to what has happened to the pitching. We thought that was going to be the strength. Dan Hayes joins us in a minute here on CCU. Dan Hayes is here to talk about the Twins. I want to give you guys a chance to ask Dan questions. So if you have anything you want to ask Dan Hayes, 651-461-9226. Dan, it's been a rough June, hasn't it?
Yeah. That would be especially the last 3 days.
Yeah.
Man, that was ugly. That was the UGLY. You ain't got no alibi.
Right.
That was so bad.
It was brutal. Yesterday was especially painful, I think. And obviously, you know, Bailey Ober is a tough deal. And you wrote a little bit, even the day before his start, about some of the physical challenges that he's been going through and some of the mechanics things that he's been struggling with?
Yeah, he said basically he's been feeling some hip discomfort. You know, it's basically he just needs maintenance. And the Twins have said it, and Bailey said it. He's pitched through worse. He's, you know, like the players play through stuff all the time. But what he's working on has definitely altered his mechanics a little bit, where he is trying to get them back. And I think he felt like he was making progress, but clearly he had a very rough day yesterday, giving up the home runs, walking six guys. I mean, there's months where he doesn't walk six guys. He's such a control specialist, and it's definitely clear he's off a little bit right now. And given the other uncertainty in the rotation, it just makes more things more difficult. Already, you know, I'd say when they're going at their full strength, it's Pablo Lopez number one, Joe Ryan two, Bailey Ober number three. And right now, their number one is out for another 11 weeks, and or maybe 7 weeks, but minimum 7 to 11 weeks. And then their number three is struggling. And so right now, the rotation's in a little bit of turmoil.
You know, I always make the point, Dan, that when you lose by 10 or 13, well, they lost by 12 on Tuesday and 13 yesterday, when you it still only counts as one loss, but it somehow feels way more dire when you just get shellacked like that.
Yeah, well, look, in games where you lose late and you're in it, those are very tough too, but at least you felt like you were in it. A game like yesterday, a game like Monday or Tuesday, both those games, you're not in it for more than an inning or two. And then they're just long days. You know, fortunately for the first one on Tuesday night, the 16-4 loss, that was like a 2-hour and 40-minute game or something like that. Right. So it was kind of quick for a shellacking. Yesterday dragged out a little bit, and it was under three, I think, also, but just a lot of time to sit around and realize you're getting your butt kicked. It's non-competitive. Fans tune out, you know. And it's not like it was an enjoyable day at the ballpark. It was raining a little
rainy,
bit.
Rainy, yeah.
Very foggy, probably smoke from the fire. The air quality was terrible. So it's not like it was a great day at the ballpark.
Which of those is your number one excuse to how poorly the Twins have been playing? Is it the smoke? Is it the rain? Is it what are we going to go
no.
with?
Like we're going with bad starting pitching.
Yeah.
We'll just be real. And look, teams go through lulls. This team, as of June 4th, was fourth in starting pitcher WAR and fifth in starting pitcher ERA in baseball out of 30. It's pretty good. And you know, the first 10, they were terrible.
Yeah.
So it's not shocking to see them go through a rough stretch, but this one, you know, with Pablo being hurt and Zibby Matthews getting hurt too, it's going to make it a little bit harder to get out of. You need your other guys performing. And that was why David Festa pitching well on Wednesday was actually it was a huge deal for this team. If David Festa can just give them a chance to win, you feel like you're going into most games with a chance to win. And winning the majority of those games, you know, some of the other ones, you're just going to have your offense out, slug the team, do it that way, whatever. But you need functional guys, and Festa doing that was a big pick-me-up.
The Twins did trade Alcala this week, and, you know, they didn't really – I mean, they got like an A.
No, it was a nothing trade.
It was a nothing trade. They were just unloading him, right, to create some room?
Yeah, and look, it's the end of an era that is disappointing. There were some good moments for Jorge Alcala, but he was brought in to be a big arm. They got him back in the Ryan Pressly trade.
Right.
Ryan Pressly has obviously been a stud since he left. The Twins had trouble unlocking him, and he needed to go to Houston to do what the Twins had suggested he do with them, and it didn't work with the Twins for whatever reason. Well, Alcala was the kind of the prize piece of that, and he just never really developed. He always struggled with lefties. I think some of it also may have been the fact that he was bounced back and forth in roles. Like, that's the guy who, honestly, to me, even though he came up as a starting pitcher, I think especially when you're throwing 100, he probably should have maxed out at one inning at a time, and there were times where the Twins needed to ask him to do two, and he struggled, and I mean, he constantly was in the manager doghouse or the coaching staff doghouse because he, you know, he's kind of a quiet guy. It was hard to get a read on him. Sometimes things happen, you know, and at the end here, he was just so low on the pecking order that it became time to move on. And frankly, it's, you know, they're probably, I think if they thought about it differently, they would have gone back a year or two and traded him when he had more value. But you never know, and you never stop taking a chance on a guy with an arm like that. And that's why they were willing to keep giving him chances. But it just didn't pan out. And you know, I mean, Jorge Alcala is a good dude. He's a family guy. I think he'll, you know, maybe he takes the lessons learned here and excels in Boston. I mean, the chance will be there for him, and he definitely is capable of doing it. But he's got to be way more consistent as a pitcher with his velocity. One day it'd be 94, one day it'd be 99. And that's not great when your coaches are going, is he hurt? What's going on? And then he could dial it back up in a second. It's just a situation that wasn't going to work out.
Dan Hayes with The Athletic here on CCO. What are the Twins going to do with Joey Wentz? This is the pitcher they grabbed off waivers from the Pirates. Obviously, he was on waivers, so I don't know that he's the solution to anything, but what's your thought on that?
Well, I think they see some potential mechanical things they like that maybe they think they can enhance him. Right now, he is sort of the second lefty in the bullpen, but he's got to earn trust to get some of those spots, and he'll pitch multiple innings like we saw him do yesterday, or like the plan was for him to do yesterday. He needs to get more outs. He needs to be successful. It was kind of rough getting the call on the first day yesterday. I think they would have loved it if they didn't have to use him and let him settle in, and instead he had to go. And the game was out of hand as it was. But I think there's hope. They said they're excited about the possibilities. I think they want to do their pitching thing and maybe convince him to throw a different pitch or try something a little different. We'll see. Haven't really got a chance to dive into that too much, but you know, it could be that he just turns out to be a body, fresh
right.
off. You know, and they have a couple long guys. Both are in the minors, and Travis Adams and Michael Tonkin, who cleared waivers today and was accepted an outright assignment back to AAA St. Paul. So he's still with the Twins. He's just not on the 40-man anymore. And it's possible one of those two guys, if Wentz comes up and doesn't succeed, that Wentz could be replaced by either Adams or Tonkin in the near future.
Royce Lewis has been in a major hitting slump. The last seven games, he's kind of turned it around. He's hitting .400 over the last seven games. Do you get for the season, he only has 18 hits? I mean, 18 hits is abysmal. That is not what you expect from a Royce Lewis. Do you think he's sort of figured something out, or what's your gut say here?
Yeah, I think he's on the right path. When he can start to do it with a little more power, that's when we know he's back. But you got to start, you got to walk before you can run. And I think he needed to do that, especially given the way he started coming back. And, in spring training, he felt really good. He had put in a lot of great work in the offseason, and he liked where he was at. He suffered the unfortunate injury, and then he kind of came back and really struggled. And, he had that 0-for-17 or whatever it was to start. It was attached to last year. Then he got a hit, and everybody was kind of excited because it was a home run, and he had a second home run robbed that day. And then he had another long stretch and 0-for. But I think that this is a good starting point for him, just to get some feel back, because I do think he's a player who he's one of those guys that has to feel good. And when he feels good, it enhances everything. And I just mean from a confidence standpoint, from a happiness standpoint, when he feels good about himself, like he's an upbeat dude, and he's had to deal with some stuff this last year that was probably mentally taxing for him. Just not being elite and at the top of his game. And he's had to deal with it twice in two seasons. So for him, that little, I think it's 8-for-14 or 8-for-17, somewhere around there, whatever you said, 400. That's a really good place to start. And, if they can now get some home runs added into that and he becomes that dynamic force again, you know, they're in a much better position to handle their pitching kind of struggles or their pitching challenge, I guess.
Yeah. All right. We sound so down. I mean, it's sort of the reality right now, right? Like not too much to be excited about, but.
Well, it's overcast. It's June and it's overcast and it's ugly. It's rainy. Come on, man. You know, this is summertime. What the heck?
Agreed. Dan, we appreciate it. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, Jason. Thanks.
Dan Hayes, you can read him at The Athletic, at theathletic.com. We'll take the temp of the team. That'll be fun in just a minute. Oh, I used my Chef IQ sense just the other day. We're making steak. I cooked it to medium rare. Chef IQ sense told me right when to take the steak off the grill. Beautiful. The Twins, Dan, the temperature, we have been hovering in the lukewarm category. Where would you, Dan Cook, put the temperature of the Twins today?
Getting chillier.
Yeah.
Getting chillier. Obviously, you and Dan just discussed that the pitching has been just flat out awful over about the last week or so. That Texas series, you just want to try and flush that one, put it behind you, and hope for better days moving forward. One bright spot.
Okay.
One small little spot of heat.
Let's hear it.
The Twins way is one Byron Buxton.
Yes!
Who's been doing his best MVP impersonation over the last week or so. Over the last week, his OPS, now granted, a major league average OPS is like around 730.
Yep.
Maybe a little bit higher than that. His OPS over the last week has been 1405.
Oh, my.
That's on-base percentage plus slugging percentage.
Right.
He's just been hitting the cover off the ball. And he had perhaps the best full inning of a Twins players ever had in terms of that diving catch.
Yes.
And then a 479-foot home run, which might still be traveling if the stadium hadn't gotten in the way. Second longest home run hit this season. And one of the longest in Twins history at Target Field. So
that was in the 6-2 win over the Rangers. Yes. Didn't they? I thought I saw on the telecast that there was like a mark where that home run hit and they were going to put like a plaque up or something.
I don't know if they're going to put a plaque up or not, but yeah, there was a mark where it hit and then I think it glanced off of one of the ushers and then jumped into the section where there was some folks standing there. And
it was so high, like when you watch the replay. The excellent photographers that they have.
Underestimated
and went low.
Yes.
Because you're
like.
They
had to pan up.
You're like, oh my goodness, that one really got.
Because people don't hit baseballs where that ball was hit. It's just crazy.
Pretty fun. Dan, we're out of time.
Yes, we are.
Whoops.
No, we're good.
All right. Henry Lake is next.